Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
We talk a lot about the pandemic here on WICC. We've talked about the aftermath. We talk a lot about kids and how they're struggling with mental health. Our suicide rates have skyrocketed in the last 2 years. So we talk about kids. We talk about worker burnout, right? We talk about people who are struggling after being at home, isolation, back in the office, still working from home, balancing act, all of that good stuff. But, you know, there's a part of the pandemic we really haven't spoken about. And that's the boom of children who were born during the pandemic. You know, we joke about it a lot. Like, what are we going to call this generation? The kids who were born during the 2020, 21, 22 years. Do we call them COVID babies? Like, obviously, we kind of laugh that off a little bit. But we know a lot of kids were born in the last 2 years. And sure, we're worried about the kids, of course. But what about the moms? You know, for anyone who knows me personally, I've been very open. I wear my heart on my sleeve on this show. And I've told you that I struggled horrifically with postpartum when I had Chase, to the point that I quit my job, my dream job that I was doing in Vermont. I left 6 weeks after having Chase and I moved back home with my mom. I had to be near my parents. I needed comfort. I needed therapy. I needed a lot for my postpartum. And by the way, Chase was not a COVID baby. So it made me think, what about the moms today who are going through postpartum in the last couple of years? What does that look like, especially while we're also dealing with an epidemic, in my opinion, which is mental health needs across America? So for that is actually a friend of mine. I've become friends with this woman, Melissa Fairhurst, because our boys go to school together. And I learned a lot about her, actually, in the last few months. And I had to have her on the show. Among many things, she is a mom, but she's also a psychotherapist, as well as she's recently become a mental health counselor specifically for postpartum. So I wanted to have Melissa on the show, and she is here this morning. Thank you so much for joining me, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So first and foremost, Melissa, tell us a little bit about your background and why you are so interested in helping moms.
Absolutely. So I am a licensed professional counselor in Connecticut. And more recently, as you just said, right before I had my third baby, I actually got certified in perinatal mental health counseling so that I could slowly start shifting my practice to helping moms who are either pregnant, maybe thinking about getting pregnant, or who are postpartum, even up to, you know, 5 years, any moms, after having a baby. So that is my more recent sort of niche, if you will, with mental health. But I have been in this field for many, many years. And obviously, as you said, with the pandemic, I've been doing most of it virtually in the past 3 years.
In your professional opinion, Melissa, how common is it for women to struggle with postpartum?
It's more common than people think. I think that what happens is moms are cared for throughout the entire pregnancy. Then the baby comes, and all of that focus, for some reason, shifts to the baby, obviously. But the mom kind of gets forgotten. So it's more common than people think. Really, if you want numbers for depression, it's 1 in 7 moms and 1 in 10 dads who will experience severe depression outside of those kind of normal, you know, baby blues.
Why does that happen, do you think? Why? And the dad thing is really interesting, too, because forget the moms. You're right. They do kind of get cast aside a little bit. But the dads, I don't think people ever consider what the dads are going through. But why do you think postpartum happens?
Well, I think right after you have a baby, and I experienced this, I know you just talked about your experience with Chase. I wasn't really aware, I think, of all the feelings that were going to come in those first few days of being home. And so I think what's happening is that there's a flood of hormones going on in the beginning, right? Most of us are, I think the number here is like 80% of moms will experience those postpartum baby blues where you start crying for no reason. But then that should really clear up around 2 weeks. It's this group of moms who have these things going past that 2 week period. And as to why it's happening, you know, there's no specific set thing. Like, this is going to happen to you. You're going to have postpartum depression. You're going to have postpartum anxiety, and you're not going to have it at all. I think a lot of it is just based on you know, your environment, what could be happening when you go home. A lot of it is a support. If actually one of the things I was looking at right before I talked to you is that the number is even greater, and this won't be surprising, for moms who are facing poverty. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into why it happens to specific moms and why it doesn't happen to other moms. I don't think there's a cookie cutter answer for that one. I think where the bigger issue is there's a lack of care, and there's a lack of resources, and there's a lack of support for these moms who the baby blues don't stop. It just keeps going and going and going, and they don't get the care that they need. And then what happens to them and what happens to their relationship with their baby and their spouses and their families.
Melissa Fairhurst is here this morning, and we're talking about moms and even dads in postpartum, which is something incredibly common. Maybe many of you don't realize because we don't talk about it enough. Melissa, I was just alerted to a news story that is actually right next door to us in Brooklyn. Apparently, three children were found dead on a beach near Coney Island, and relatives this morning believe the mother was struggling from postpartum. Now, of course, that's according to a few different publications. It's very early. That's a very early speculation. But it does actually lead to a question I have, which we've heard of this before, where unfortunately mothers have done this. And so my question for you, Melissa, is how long can someone struggle with postpartum, and what happens if it's not addressed?
Yeah, so just to start with the latter, if it's not addressed, the best way that I like to describe this to even clients or people that I talk to in my personal life is when you're on an airplane and the stewardess comes on and she gives the warning about, you know, if we get into a situation where you will require oxygen, the oxygen mask will drop down. And one of the key things that they always say is to put the mask on yourself before helping your children or anybody next to you. Because if the mask isn't on you, then how are you going to help the people next to you? And so that's how I think when I'm working with these moms about them. If we don't take care of you, if the mom's not taking care of herself, not just physically but mentally, how can we expect that mom to then turn around in her day-to-day and take care of one child, two child, three children? It's impossible. So if we don't get the care that we need when we're struggling with our mental health, that then has this sort of domino effect on everything else in our lives. Like I said before, it has an effect on how you interact with your children. Maybe you're short, you don't have as much patience. I think we've all experienced that as parents. Maybe you feel isolated, you can't get out of the house, so you don't meet with other moms. You don't realize that there's a whole community out there who's experiencing similar things to you. So that's just answer the latter part of your question. And then, of course, the story that you just shared about what happened in Coney Island. I remember before getting into this field, I would hear these stories. You know, there's one from many, many years ago that I heard about when I was younger. And we think, like, how could you ever do that, right? You could never do that. I would never do that. Mm. And then I got into this field and I started learning about postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, because there's perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. It's not just depression. There's anxiety. There's postpartum OCD. There's postpartum psychosis. So there's all of these mood and anxiety disorders that we as professionals know about, but a mom might not know about, right? So you start to have these intrusive thoughts about doing harm, you know, to your child, and maybe they're passing, right? And that's normal, but maybe they're not passing. Maybe they're real. And so now being in this field and I hear these stories, instead of getting angry and feeling like, well, she should have done something, I feel more compassion for this. Obviously, it's absolutely terrible what the ending of the story is, but I feel compassion for this mother who didn't know what to do and was struggling and had no help and had no support around how to process these feelings and get the help that she needed. And so the ending is absolutely tragic. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, yes, it is very rare for that to be the ending. It's not unheard of.
Yeah.
And that's really scary.
And have you seen, Melissa, an uptick in people inquiring about needing help because of what the last 2 years has brought on society?
1,000%. I think all mental health therapists in every, you know, in every niche would agree that since the pandemic, there has been a significant uptick in calls. And you know what? a lot of the people that I speak with go through calling like 10, 15 therapists a day, and nobody has the availability to fit them in. And one thing that has come out of the pandemic that I think has been helpful for people, especially parents, working parents too, is telehealth. It was always a thing, but it's more of a thing now because of COVID. And so that has given parents who have little ones who can't get to an office, or people who are working and they can't get somewhere until 6 o'clock at night and there's no availability, or the weekend, that's given people freedom to sort of schedule in a 12 o'clock therapy session, you know, instead of their lunch break at Panera Bread. But definitely an uptick. Absolutely.
So, Melissa, I think you have a wealth of knowledge. You also have an amazing voice. you could read bedtime stories whenever you want. You have an amazing voice. And and I just think you have an incredible knowledge on this topic when there are so many people who need help with this and maybe are afraid to come out and talk about it a little bit more. Is there a way people can contact you or find you if they wanted to learn more information or be able to talk to you about these things?
Yes, so I can give my email, and then also I have a profile on Psychology Today where people could read a little bit more about my background, and then right there they could actually call from the website or send me an email.
That would be great. Yeah. So what is that that website?
I don't have. You know what? They could just go right onto Psychology Today and plug my name in.
Oh, okay, great.
And I will come right up.
Okay, perfect. That would be
so
great.
PsychologyToday.com, and then search my my name.
Okay, that's excellent. And I will also, when I put Melissa's segment up on my podcast at 10 o'clock this morning, I will also add that website and I'll spell out Melissa's name so that you guys can find her if you want to get more information. Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk to us about this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. That's Melissa Fairhurst here on WICC. And again, I will put that website up on the podcast later this morning with this whole segment with Melissa if you missed
it. So I was reading a statistic recently that I thought was pretty concerning and something that Julie Bauke could tackle for this week. It says nearly 2 in 5 American college graduates have major regrets. And when I say major regrets, I don't mean, oh, I regret getting drunk at that party so many times during my 4 years of college. I mean regrets with the major they chose. So why is that happening? Julie Bauke, who's our career strategist, she is here each and every week to tackle new, I think, topics of business and just the economic life that we are living in right now, helping us to navigate and guide us through what's going on with job markets and things like that. So Julie, welcome back. So glad you're here. How are you?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. This is, I love this topic
because
it's got so, it's got so many layers. So from a big picture perspective, one of the things that is missing is a connect, like sort of a, there's a disconnect between high school, college, and then what you're going to do next. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fault to go around. So the, you know, there has to be, when you choose a major, you know, you have to think about more than what classes do I enjoy. You have to think about where is this leading me? And so from a parental standpoint, I think you have to, you know, you sit down with Junior and you're talking about, you know, you've got college funds set up or you don't. But, you know, and we all know that 17, 18 year olds are just, you know, such good listeners to their parents, she says sarcastically. But if you're going to pay for your child to go away for 4 years or take out loans or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you have to have some certainty it's leading to something. So, and it's so, but we don't have those conversations. We let our kids pick a major based on what they like and love. And there's, I'm not saying that's all bad, but I'm saying it has to be tempered with what career does this lead to? And then that's where colleges come in. And every college has a career planning and placement office, and you as a freshman or your child should be in there on, you know, the first year. Don't wait until spring your senior year to say, I guess I need a job. You know, you've got to go in there and say, okay, so here's what I'm majoring in, or here's what I'm thinking of majoring in. Tell me who comes to campus to interview for these. Help me understand which alums of this college who majored in this, what have they gone on to do? So you've got to connect what you're majoring in with what you are likely to do when you graduate. And if those jobs don't sound interesting to you, you maybe need to rethink. So if you are very interested in a liberal arts or humanities minor or those classes, maybe you do it as a minor, but you supplement it with something with hard skills. And what I mean by hard skills are sort of those left brain skills, accounting, finance, business in general, economics, engineering. I mean, you're some sort of like, you know, I'm not, you know, you can take those classes that you enjoy, but if you're not, I can't even tell you, Melissa, back in my early career years, I was in HR and we would do on-campus interviews. Spring semester, senior year, let's say I interviewed 12 kids in a day. I'm going to tell you that 9 or 10 of them at least had no clue, had no better idea what they wanted to do at the end of 4 years and multiple thousands of dollars than they did the day they first set foot on campus.
You know,
and that is a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. And you know what's interesting about that, Julie? A couple of things, if we can unpack what you just said. I do love this topic. Julie Bauke is here, our career strategist. And what I think is interesting about that is, first of all, I came from an era, if you will, where it was so frowned upon to go, hey, you know what? I'm not ready for college yet. I'm one of five. We all went to college. We all did our thing. And we all somehow, knock on wood, well, I do know how we did it, but we all ended up being okay. But I don't remember which sibling. I think it was my youngest sibling. But I remember one of them going to my mom and saying, you know, I think I'm going to take a gap year. And literally the direct quote was, the hell you are. I mean, I just was an era that we grew up in, which was like, absolutely not. I mean, you're not just going to go get a job. And because we came from parents of a generation where it was a privilege to go to college, and most didn't. Like, my mom did not go to college. She got her associates when she was in her upper 20s, already raising children because she felt it was important. But like, it was not something that you just did. So there's that disconnect. But then on top of it, it is really interesting that we don't like talk to our kids about what does this look like. So I remember for myself, I wanted to be a sideline reporter for the Miami Dolphins. Don't ask me why. I wanted to be a sports broadcast. That's what I wanted to do. Knew nothing about it, but I just knew I wanted to be on the field with the football players. And what my parents did was they were like, all right, you think you want to go to school for broadcasting? All right, great. So why don't you go shadow some places? And what's interesting is, you know, 15 years ago, I shadowed the company that owned WICC. And I realized so friggin' fast, first of all, how hard it is to be in this industry. But second of all, that I like sports, but I don't like sports broadcasting. Like, it's just very boring. And so when I went to school, they were like, you sure you want to go to a broadcasting school, or would you rather go to a communications school where you could do advertising, marketing, PR, public speaking? You know, like, there were more things you could do, which is what you were speaking to, versus I'm going to be a broadcaster, because it's so narrow when you have this very specific major and there's not a lot of opportunity. Or if you do find the opportunity, you're not getting paid very well. Like, those are things that I don't think those conversations are happening as often as they should.
No. And there are those opportunities. A lot of schools actually do a really good job in having information sessions, having companies come in and talk about what this job does for them. But you actually have to sign up and show up. And that's the challenge. I know that colleges try really hard in a lot of cases to make those opportunities available. And they're right there if you want to go talk to them. Mm-hmm. But we don't, when you're 18 to 22, it's such a tough, those are such tough years, because the world feels overwhelming. And we look at like our buddy that we grew up with, who's known since he was 8, he wanted to be a doctor. And we think, well, why don't I have that kind of self-knowledge? And I tell people, look, your buddy, you know, chances are, you know, there's probably a pretty darn good chance that your buddy who decided he wanted to be a doctor at 8 is going to change his mind.
Yeah, he's not going to be a doctor.
Go, oh my.
Or it's like his parents do it. Right. Yeah, you're right.
So we change multiple times as we evolve as humans in terms of what we want to do for work. And to think that you're going to pick one thing and stick with it for 40 years is old thinking, and I don't think it's healthy thinking. But you've got to at least get a start in something that puts you on a path that you're at least reasonably interested in.
Interesting.
And unless you are sure you want to be a professor or something that you absolutely have to have that liberal arts major in, or humanities major, or history of foreign language, whatever it is, you've got to do it. It's such a shame to spend the money that colleges charge, which is another issue, to walk out and go on, well, this degree without a master's of some sort, didn't qualify me for anything. Mm-hmm. That information was out there from the day you stepped a foot on campus. And as a parent, requiring your child to through the 4 years they're there, not just have fun or go to class, but to actually have some thoughts about what does the future look like and force those conversations. I think it should be a requirement of the tuition that you're paying.
Julie Balke is here, and national information, I should say some statistics are saying nearly 2 in 5 American college graduates are not happy with the major they picked after they graduate. They go into the working world. I'm curious, Julie, is part of that because we find that, okay, we followed our dreams, right? We followed our dreams. We did our thing. We got the major we wanted. This is the job we've wanted. Great. Awesome. But then you enter that world and you're like, you're like either A, oh my God, they pay like garbage, or this is just not what I want to do. This is not good quality of life for me. We're very focused on mental health lately. Or B, I love this one, I want to have a family, and this job just doesn't work for that. So I have both examples that I'm very familiar with. And the most recent is my sister, who's getting married next year. Went to school for 6 years, you know, all that, is a physical therapist, and already has said to her new husband, you know, in the next like 3 to 5 years, I think I want to pull back to part time to eventually be a full time stay at home mom, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But his immediate response is, wait, so your parents dropped all that money for you to just quit by the time you're 30? Like, I just want to make sure I've got this right. But it's true, because I don't think about that, which colleges don't talk to you about. Like, they could talk till you're blue in the face about what your career looks like. But the real part, like, you know, your marriage may struggle. You may not be able to have more than one kid or any kids at all. You may not make a lot of money. Like, those are things, honestly, I did not know about my industry when I entered it as a broadcaster. I wish I did know it, but I mean, we're making it work and it's fine. But like, those are things that you don't learn in college and you don't really learn in high school unless you ask people who are in the industry and they're real with you.
Right. And there's, you know, that there's a government resource called the Occupational Outlook Handbook that's actually really good. It talks about what occupations, it kind of talks about pay, talks about what occupations are going to grow and shrink in the next several years. And so you have to, there's a variety of sources, but start with, you know, when you go to, you know, your first visit to college, or you are, let's say, you know, you're a freshman, figure out where your career planning and placement office is. Make friends with somebody in there and have conversations with them once a semester. Who can I talk to who's in this industry? How can I find out what the future looks like in this industry? Who can I shadow? And then when we talk about kind of summer jobs and internships and all that, when you only take classes during the summer and don't do any sort of work, I think you're missing out on that opportunity. Those summers in between are the perfect time to test your hypothesis that this is the right job for you, either by talking to people or getting out there doing internships, doing a co-op program, shadowing. Take those opportunities so that when you graduate, you have as much knowledge as is possible for a 22-ish year old to have about what you're getting into. Not only does that make you more attractive to a potential employer, but you're more likely to step onto a path that, you know, at least upfront is going to be fulfilling. And let's say then you get there and you're there for 2 years and you say, okay, you know, this is a great place to start, but my interest lies more over here. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. Just because you pick a field that you end up pivoting from, that's actually, from what I've seen in doing this 25 plus years, the happiest people at mid to later age career-wise are people who've changed paths a few times because they aligned their careers with what they learned about themselves. Mm. So, you know, this, you know, it's just, you know, we are, sometimes I'll talk to a late 20s and they'll say, well, blah, blah, blah. My parents say, and I'll say, no, they're wrong. here's the reality. They're giving you boomer advice. Mm. And the boomer advice was, grab a job, hold on to it. If you quit, you know, before 20 years, you're a job hopper, you know, and hang on until you're 62, 63 years old, then you can have fun. And that is wrong on so many levels. Mm. But so is the idea that magic is going to happen during your 4 plus years at college. and you're going to be fully formed and, you know, ready to go kill the world. And, you know, it's just easy to look at these people who get jobs right out of school and think, oh, they have it all figured out. No, they don't. In fact, none of us have it figured out.
I was going to say, I feel like I still don't have it figured out.
No, you have another career change in front of you. You know, and you know, I talked to this kid a few weeks ago or last couple months ago, and he's like, I'm 33. I'm too old to change careers. I'm like, are you kidding me?
I want to be a fly on the wall in your office, Julie, when you get these phone calls. I love it. Oh, my gosh.
Wow. You are drinking the Kool-Aid. And,
right.
You know, there's just, you have to look at what is your family conversation around that? Mm-hmm. What did your parents do for work? If they were in the same job for 30 plus years, were they miserable? Well, you don't want that.
Right.
Were they happy?
Right.
Well, why? Find that out. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like putting a loaf of bread in the oven for four years of college and you come out fully baked and tasty.
Right.
You know, you've got
exactly.
There's a lot of hard work.
You're right. And I think, Julie Balke, you make a lot of sense. And that's why we have a weekly segment with you, because I think you just get down to the nitty gritty of it and you make sense of things that may be very archaic and have been the same way for a long time, but it's not working in today's world. So
it's not going to work. Nope.
Yeah, it's not. And I appreciate you being so honest and forthright about it. And I can't wait to see what we're going to dive into next week. Julie Balke, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Melissa.
All right. Looking forward to it. Julie Balke here, our career strategist on WICC. I always say there's not a lot the human race has in common with each other. However, everyone knows someone with a story about cancer, whether it's a family member, a friend, a colleague, or maybe it's your own story of survival. American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network representatives, including survivors and even doctors from Connecticut, are going to be some of the first heading to Capitol Hill after it reopens to the public. And they are meeting with lawmakers so that they can advocate for more funding for cancer research. So I wanted to talk about this morning with Linda Alderman. She's Connecticut's state lead ambassador for American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Good morning, Linda. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Melissa. I'm so happy to be on with you.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here, too. So, Linda, you know, I do find this a little surprising, and that's why I wanted to have you on, because I feel like if you ask the normal, the everyday person, 5Ks, 10Ks, fundraisers, bake sales, you name it, I feel like 9 times out of 10, it goes to cancer research. So what's missing here? What is being advocated for? What's sort of the missing link to moving forward with cancer research?
That's a great question. I want to back up just a little bit and just explain to the listeners about what the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network actually is.
Yeah, please do.
Most people know about the work of the American Cancer Society, but most don't know about our work. We're the American Cancer Society's advocacy arm. We work to eradicate cancer by advocating for federal funding for cancer research and for changes to federal and state laws that will help cancer patients and their families. And you're right, there is all kinds of local fundraising for cancer research, and that's certainly helpful. But the federal funding makes up the vast majority of the funding that's required, and that's what we're here to advocate for in D.C. And I'm passionate about this work because I'm a 2-time breast cancer survivor.
Wow.
I was first diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer in 2008 when I was 45. And then I was diagnosed with a regrowth of breast cancer in 2013. But I'm happy to say that I've been cancer-free for 9 years.
God bless you.
And today is, thank you. Today is, and I'm not alone. There's so many people like me who are listening and who are out there. And as you were saying, cancer affects everyone. Today is such an exciting day for the 530 ACS CAN volunteers representing all 50 states who are in D.C. We'll be meeting with every congressional member to fight for research funding. And as a cancer survivor, I know that were it not for breakthroughs in cancer research from prior funding, that I wouldn't have lived to see our 2 sons grow up. They were 12 and 15 when I was first diagnosed. And I want to be sure that we continue investing in new cures and treatments so that more people can live longer and better lives despite their diagnosis. And my Connecticut team which is incredible. We'll be meeting with all seven Connecticut congressional offices today to send a really important message. And that's that there's no better way for Congress to demonstrate support for the fight against cancer than by funding advancements in research.
So we're talking
money that go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to reintroduce that. We're talking to Linda Alderman, Connecticut's state lead ambassador for American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And today, Connecticut and all the other states of the United States are going to be speaking with lawmakers pushing for more money to support cancer research. And Linda, do you feel like we have made advances, that we've gotten to a better place with cancer research, or do you think we have been lacking because we're not putting enough money into it?
Well, absolutely. Past research and past funding have moved us along. Death rates from cancer have declined 29% since 1991 because of past bipartisan investment. The NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health, and the NCI, which is the National Cancer Institute, which make up the foundation of our National Cancer Research Program through their support of research in every state, have made great strides. But we are calling on Congress to increase medical research funding at the NIH by $4.1 billion in the 2023 federal budget, to $49 billion.
That's a big jump.
And by $853 million. Yeah. And by $853 million to $7.7 billion for the NCI. And it's so important, Melissa, because our nation's fast growing cancer burden demands sustained increases in federal investment if we're going to keep moving forward. Cancer research is one of the most dynamic scientific areas of discovery, yet NCI is unable to fund hundreds of high-quality research applications every year. And without the increases in funding, we risk losing a generation of young investigators and slowing progress. And we need to keep moving forward. Connecticut residents are depending on our congressional members to support this research funding and to help move progress along and to help with cancer research in the future.
When's the last time, Linda, if you know, when's the last time we saw an increase in medical research funding from Congress? Do we know when that's been?
We were able to get an increase last year, and we were really grateful for that. But with inflation and with the impact of COVID and funds going elsewhere, we're really concerned that we won't get the increases that we need just to keep afloat. And so I know it sounds like a lot of money, and it is, but it's all really necessary to keep research moving forward, to keep the progress moving, and to keep people alive.
And if people do want to learn more information, you can go to fightcancer.org. Again, the website is fightcancer.org. And Linda, I want to wish you and all of the Connecticut representatives luck going to speak with lawmakers about this potential increase in funding. And again, I'm so glad to hear that you are healthy and you're doing well and you're able to do your advocacy work and continuing that this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melissa. It's truly a pleasure.
Linda Alderman, again, so glad to have you here this morning. And Linda is the Connecticut State Lead Ambassador for American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. If you want to learn more, head on over to fightcancer.org.